From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! You say you want a devolution? That's what Noam Chomsky calls the Republican agenda. Devolution, not revolution.
The consequences of devolution are quite straightforward. It means that any funding that goes, say, block grants that go to the states, you can be reasonably confident that they'll end up in the deep pockets of rich people, not in the hands of hungry children or poor mothers or anything like that. That's how you get power down to the people.
Coming up, America's leading intellectual explains the shift and the shaft, how current cuts in the public sector benefit the rich and hurt working people. Also, Reverend Lucius Walker has been fasting for 85 days to challenge the U.S. embargo on Cuba. Is his strategy working? All coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. More than three decades after he was clubbed by police during a milestone civil rights demonstration, Georgia Congressman John Lewis has led a successful drive to formally recognize the march. The Democrat has won House approval of a bill designating the 1965 march route from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, a National Historic Trail. The measure was passed by voice vote in the House after Lewis urged recognition to the men and women who sacrificed so much for voting rights in America. It now goes to the Senate. The march was turned back violently by sheriffs and state troopers. March 7, 1965 became known as Bloody Sunday. It was largely responsible for President Johnson signing the Voting Rights Act into law 5 months later. And in order to battle an embarrassing and potentially costly sexual harassment lawsuit, Mitsubishi has hired former Labor Secretary Lynn Martin to review the company's policies. This in the face of a lawsuit being brought by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Martin's appointment drew questions from Washington, where Congressmember Patricia Schroeder said it amounted to public relations and spin control. The EEOC filed suit April 9th in federal court, seeking back pay with interest and benefits, as well as compensatory and punitive damages that could reach $300,000 each for as many as 700 female employees at the plant. And Chinese-American human rights activist Harry Wu is saying that President Clinton and Bob Dole are giving China a free lunch by supporting its most favored nation trade status. Wu said both candidates should tell China it must improve its human rights record to enjoy the profits of favorable U.S. trade status. And yesterday, Bob Dole won West Virginia and Nebraska primaries. The winning streak is continuing to grow. And so Bob Dole plans to give up his day-to-day Senate management role and focus squarely on framing a Republican case against President Clinton. A handful of Republican sources speaking to the Associated Press on condition of anonymity said Dole would not resign as Senate Majority Leader. Instead, they said he would announce he was keeping the title and power, but yielding most Senate duties to GOP leadership deputies led by Whip Trent Lott of Mississippi, a close ally of Newt Gingrich. As members of Congress led by Newt Gingrich are currently fighting for an increase in military spending, we turn to a recent speech of MIT professor Noam Chomsky. He talks about how the U.S. budget is looking increasingly like the structural adjustment programs the U.S. imposes on developing countries.
The Washington Consensus, which is basically designed for the third world to make it that way and keep it that way, it's now being applied not just to the third world countries, but to the rich industrial societies, with the United States and Britain in the lead. However, it's with a twist. Since it's being applied at home, this is really existing free market theory that's being applied at home, meaning nuanced. So powerful government to protect the rich and market discipline and tough love for everyone else. You see that very clearly. Go through the various elements of the Washington Consensus that I mentioned. The first one is about reducing government. That's false. We're not reducing government. We're switching it, shifting it around. So social spending is indeed way down since the 1970s when this stuff started, accelerated after 1980, but it was starting in the mid-70s. Kind of a benchmark example is AFDC, the main support system. That was cut virtually in half from about 1970 to 1990, with obvious effects on were families and children and so on. It was part of a general war against women and children that was conducted by the conservatives under the name of family values. It's interesting that they were able to get away with that. That tells you something about the intellectual culture. Well, one part was the reduction of AFDC by roughly half from about 1970 to about 1990. It's now essentially gone. Purpose of that, as you know, is so that 7 million, a couple of million, I think 5 or 6 million kids, average 7 years old, can learn responsibility. That's part of tough love. Meanwhile, another part of the government has been very stable and, in fact, is going up, namely the Pentagon system, which remains at approximately Cold War levels. In fact, it's higher now than it was under Nixon, although, you know, the big enemy has disappeared, which tells you exactly how much, tells a rational person at least, exactly how much they were worried about the Russian threat. Not only does it remain at Cold War levels, but it's going up under the initiative of the fiscal conservatives. The Heritage Foundation, which, you know, sort of the right-wing foundation that designs the budget for the Gingrich Army, are calling for an increase in the Pentagon system, as is Gingrich, as indeed was Clinton. So that goes up. I should say that cutting of social spending, social spending is being cut very sharply, very much over public opposition. At the time of the 1994 congressional election, you know, the big landslide, over 60% of the public wanted social spending to increase. Okay, went very sharply down. What about Pentagon spending going up? Well, that's the public is 6-1 opposed to that, which gives you some one aspect of a big picture about what's happening to American democracy. I mean, somewhat of a change, not a huge change. So one part of the system is going up, Pentagon spending. Another part's going down, social spending. And the same is true in other domains. Like, for example, legal aid for the poor is being slashed and virtually destroyed. On the other hand, the security system, the government security system, state and federal, that's going up. So prisons are going way up. The prison population, crime hasn't changed for about 20 years. But incidentally, U.S. crime rates are not off the spectrum, contrary to what a lot of people believe. Crime rates are sort of toward the high end of the industrial world, but not off the spectrum, with one exception, namely murder with guns. But that's a special feature of American society, which doesn't have to do with crime rates. Apart from that, crime rates are kind of toward the high end, not going up. The prison population tripled during the Reagan years, is going up even faster now. And I think the reason is another aspect of the third world model, namely the superfluous population. There is a big superfluous population. They don't contribute to wealth protection. Well, we're civilized folks. We're not like the people we fund in Colombia who go out and murder them, so we throw them into jail. That's going way up in even more. And there's also a kind of like a side benefit to this. The putting more and more people in jail, and in fact under harsher and harher conditions, is a technique of social control for everybody else. I mean, someday down the road you decide to run a dictatorship and you want to really harm people, it's kind of like Hitler Germany or something, you know, you know that you're going to carry out policies that are going to cause people a lot of harm. You got to control them somehow. And there aren't many ways to do it. Everyone hits on the same ways. What you do is engender fear and hatred and, you know, make them hate the guy who looks a little different or whatever it may be. Then you punish those bad guys because they're really awful and you punish them really hard and so on, and that makes people even more frightened. You can just see that happening right around you. And building up the perception of crime. Crime has what they call in literary theory a subtext. You're supposed to understand criminal has the little word black in front of it, just like welfare mother, you know, black, rich black, welfare mother. And criminal means, you know, that black guy is coming after you. So what you want to do is, this has the dual effect of getting rid of a superfluous population, basically unskilled workers, you know, close race, class correlation, also demonizing them, so everybody else is scared and frightened, and they'll be willing to accept what's happening to them too and not look at where the source is. So that part of the drug wars, basically, for this has almost nothing to do with drugs, but it has plenty to do with criminalizing an unwanted population and scaring everybody else. And so does the harshening of prison conditions, which is really, the United States is off the map on this one, in violation of international conventions, constantly condemned in human rights forums and getting much worse. The reinstitution of chain gangs was, of course, bitterly condemned, but, you know, that's that bad South, Alabama. Well, it's now in Illinois. The state senate of Illinois last week or two ago legislated chain gangs, not for violent criminals, incidentally, for people who are found with drugs or, you know, robbed a store or something like that. The Chicago Press pointed out that this carries this kind of reminiscent of slavery. But the legislator and the senator, state senator who put it through, said that this is just another aspect of what he called tough love. And then he explained that some people work better under humiliation. So it's really good to restore elements of slavery. And again, the subtext is everybody else gets scared. You know, if those guys have to walk around like slaves in chains, we must be in real danger, so therefore we'll accept what's happening to us. That's the logic. So prisons are going up, and that has a lot of side benefits, apart from just getting rid of the superfluous population. It is a source of cheap labor, so prison labor is going way up. Cheap labor, you don't have to worry about unions, no benefits, they don't get out of line. And that also naturally undercuts wages elsewhere. So when just like forcing welfare mothers to work, you know, raising children isn't work, as anybody knows who's had children. So you have to drive them to work, kind of like people who go to, you know, Fidelity Investment to figure out scams about how to deal with the security market. You really want these people to work. But since there's no jobs for them, they're going to work at low-paid or publicly subsidized wages, which will undercut other wages. And the same with prison labor. In fact, the scale of prison construction, which is a kind of Keynesian stimulus to the economy anyway, but its scale has become so enormous that even high-tech industry, you know, the guys who are usually just ripping off the Pentagon system, they're beginning to look at it, figuring out, recognizing that high-tech surveillance devices and so on may be another way to sort of get the transfer of public funds to make sure that high-tech industry keeps moving its reach. It's not the scale of the Pentagon, but it's going up. Well, that's one aspect of what's called reducing government, modifying government, to be more precise. Another aspect of it is what's called devolution, you know, reducing, moving governmental power from the federal to the state level. And that has a kind of a rationale which you hear all over the place. For example, there was an op-ed a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times by John Cogan of Hoover Institute at Stanford, who pointed out what he called a philosophical issue that divides the Democrats and the Republicans. The philosophical issue is that the Democrats believe in big government and entitlement, and the Republicans believe in getting power down closer to the people, to the states, because they're kind of populist types. Well, it takes about maybe 3 seconds thought to realize that moving power down to the states in funding and so on is just moving it away from the people for perfectly elementary reason. There's a hidden part of the system, of the power system, that you're not supposed to know about or think about, and that's private power. Now, it takes a big corporation like, say, General Electric or Microsoft to sort of pressure the federal government, but even middle-sized guys have no problems with state governments. They can control them quite easily. And in case anyone was too dull to figure this out by themselves, the same day as Cogan's op-ed in the New York Times, which is a typical one, there was a story in the Wall Street Journal about Massachusetts, which had a headline that read, "What Fidelity Investment wants, it usually gets." Okay. And then the story went on to say that Fidelity Investment, the biggest investment firm in Massachusetts, wanted even more subsidy and support from the state government that it already gets, and it was threatening if it didn't, it would move over the border to Rhode Island, where it just owns the place. So therefore, the passionately libertarian governor quickly rearranged, you know, tax subsidies and one thing or another so that Fidelity got what it wanted. Well, Fidelity couldn't have done that with the federal government. Couldn't have said, you know, you give us even more, we're going to move to Switzerland or something. I mean, other guys can do it maybe, but not Fidelity. Raytheon, which is the biggest manufacturing producer, did the same thing. Raytheon, incidentally, Fidelity is not, it's not that Fidelity is poor. They just announced record profits a couple of days ago. Same with Raytheon, just announced record profits, but, you know, having big problems. So they wanted even a bigger tax subsidy and direct subsidy and tax write-offs, which just means transfer of taxes, to from the state of Massachusetts. And they threatened if they didn't get them, they were going to go to Tennessee. So, of course, they got them. The legislature passed a special law giving what they call defense industry special extra subsidies. Notice that Raytheon is publicly subsidized in the first place. That's where its money comes from. But now it has to be additionally subsidized so that its profits will be even higher than the record profits it just made. Same with Fidelity. And that's the kind of game anybody can, you know, even way down the much smaller businesses can play with states. So moving devolution, the consequences of devolution are quite straightforward. It means that any funding that goes to, say, block grants that go to the states, you can be reasonably confident that they'll end up in the deep pockets of rich people, not, you know, in the hands of hungry children or poor mothers or anything like that. That's how you get power down to the people. Okay, that's devolution. In fact, quite generally, when you look at it, what's called government cutting is more or less cost transfer. It's almost never reduction. Sometimes it's increase. So let's take what's called health reform. Reform is a word you always ought to watch out for. You know, like when Mao started the Cultural Revolution, it wasn't called a reform. You know, reform is a change that you're supposed to like. Okay, and watch. So as soon as you hear the word reform, you kind of reach for your wallet and see who's lifting it. Anyhow, there are things called health reforms. And the health reforms are supposed to, you know, cut government costs. Well, they do cut one kind of cost, but of course they raise another kind of cost. And furthermore, it's no big secret. So, like, the Wall Street Journal had a headline which pointed out that when the reforms were, you know, moving through Congress, it said, rich gain, poor lose, trade-offs for the middle class, okay? Which is right. That's exactly what the reforms are intended to do. You have to remember, by middle class, they mean the people right below the very rich. So they don't mean the median. You know, they're not talking about people with $30,000 a year income. They mean every, you know, so what it really means is great for the rich, super rich, trade-offs for the near rich, tough business, tough love for everybody else, which is most everyone. When you close public hospitals and that sort of thing, you know exactly who's going to suffer. Well, let's go to what are called, take, say, New York, which has a conservative governor and a conservative mayor. And they're carrying out very extensive conservative tax cuts because they're fiscal conservatives. The tax cuts, the New York Times pointed out in a small item, all benefit business. So by accident, all the tax cuts benefit business. Well, there are also tax increases, which are compensating for the tax cuts, but they don't call them tax increases. What they call them is, the phrase is, reduction of subsidies for public transportation and for tuition in public universities. Well, subsidy itself is another interesting word, kind of like reform. It's a subsidy if public funds are used for public purposes. That's called a subsidy. It's not called a subsidy when they go to private wealth. That's reform or something. So they're cutting down subsidies for public transportation. Well, that's just a tax. You know, if you pay 20% more for getting on the subway, that's a tax. Same if you pay higher tuition at City College. You know, and that's a highly regressive tax. So who rides the subways, and who goes to City College? So what they're doing is cutting taxes for business, for the rich, and increasing taxes for the poor, which are going to compensate for that. And that's called fiscal conservatism.
MIT professor Noam Chomsky, America's leading progressive intellectual, speaking recently at an all-day forum at Harvard University sponsored by Jobs for Justice. The speech was recorded by Chuck Rosina of WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And if you know of an interesting speech coming up, why don't you record it or let us know about it? We'll give the number at the end of the show. I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Democracy Now!, the election year program that tracks right-wing movements worldwide. In the 1960s, it wasn't unusual to hear activists call members of the power elite and politicians fascist. But was the use of this explosive term red-hot rhetoric, or just telling it like it was? Stanley Payne is a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin at Madison and author of The History of Fascism, 1914 to 1945. He explains the origins and meaning of fascism.
Fascism originated with an extreme nationalist movement in Italy at the end of World War I. But the term creates a great deal of confusion because, unlike other major political terms, the word in itself doesn't really mean anything. That is, liberalism has to do with liberty, socialism with social organization and ownership, conservatism with a concern to conserve, but fascism doesn't tell us anything. It comes from a basic Italian word that had to do with leagues or unions, very common in Italian radical politics at the beginning of the 20th century. But the fascism, as it developed as an ism, of course, developed specific characteristics in Italy and in Europe in the period between the wars. But they're not given to us simply by the nature of the word itself. One has to make the historical reference to what the historic fascist movements were really like.
And what were they like? Who started them?
Well, Benito Mussolini, of course, was the first leading fascist. The Italian Fascist Party was begun in 1919. Other essentially similar fascist-type parties developed in a great many European countries and indeed in countries around the world in the 20s and 30s. But of the fascist-type parties, by far the most important, the most powerful, the most destructive, the one that we remember most is the Nazi Party in Germany under Adolf Hitler.
What defines fascism? When you say the Nazis are fascist, Mussolini was fascist, what are the essential characteristics?
There is no absolute agreement about that. I'll have to simply tell you how I define fascism myself. The way I use the term fascist is to refer to these movements in Europe during the era of world wars, 1920s and 30s and early 40s, in terms of an extreme nationalist movement oriented toward nationalist rebirth, the resurrection of the nation, with a philosophical basis in an action philosophy of vitalism and pragmatism and even a kind of neo-idealism, but rejecting rationalism and materialism, a movement that aimed both at a mass movement and elite leadership, highly authoritarian with the leadership principle, and particularly with a philosophy of violence as an end as well as a means, and an orientation toward militarism and toward empire.
Where does fascism stand today in Europe? What happened after World War II?
What essentially happened, of course, is that with the complete destruction of fascist Italy and Nazi Germany in 1945, fascism was literally destroyed physically, and as a major political force, obliterated more than any of the major isms of the 20th century. Nonetheless, there is the phenomenon of neo-fascism. That is, there are lots of genuine neo-fascist and neo-Nazi parties in the Western world and other parts of the world today. But these are all small and tiny sects. What's happened in Europe, for example, since World War II, is that any time a political movement inspired or partially inspired by fascism has wanted to become politically successful, it's had to defascistize itself more and more. The more it wanted to gain popular following, the more it has had to defascistize itself. And so there's a kind of iron law of neo-fascist politics in Europe since 1945 that you can't win politically with a directly neo-fascist movement. You have to change it into something much more moderate. And that's why in Italy, where there's always been the strongest partly neo-fascist movement, the Italian movement has become essentially a conservative parliamentary party and is no longer really a fascist movement. That's the cost of becoming a popular mass party.
In fascism, would you say there is a powerful component of hate against certain groups? Is that a necessary element of it?
There is a necessary sense of a strong antagonism, and usually it comes out expressed as hate towards certain other groups. That's correct. I think that's a fair observation.
And where is it strongest today outside the United States?
As a specific development or projection of historical fascism, it really is not strong as such anywhere, because the genuine neo-Nazi and neo-fascist parties are really no more than small sects. Where you have the analogs, and this I think is what should concern people, where you have the analogs to something that is not that maybe the same thing as historical fascism, but at least has some of the characteristics, will be where one finds very strongly and aggressively nationalistic movements and regimes, for example, in Eastern Europe, in the Balkans, in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. What about the United States today?
The United States, of course, there are a variety of genuine neo-fascist and neo-Nazi movements. These are tiny sects, and so they don't really have any political influence. What one finds, however, are various groups, whether or not they call themselves neo-fascist or neo-Nazis, that have been influenced by various aspects of fascism and Nazism. And although these are not significant as political forces, what catches people's attention is the fact that some of them are very violent, and they cause a great deal of destruction.
We're talking to Professor Stanley Payne. He's a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he has a new book out called A History of Fascism, 1914 to 1945. You're listening to Democracy Now! Can you talk about, have you studied some of the groups in this country that do call themselves neo-Nazi or neo-fascist?
Not in any detail, because I'm an historian, really, of Europe, and I don't study fringe element of American politics very much. But you have, of course, a very elaborate taxonomy of American extremist groups of all different kinds. As I say, some are categorically neo-fascist. Others are simply influenced by fascist ideas, not so much by fascist techniques as by fascist ideas.
Which are?
In practice, ideas of race, of extreme nationalism, of conspiracy and paranoia. I think these are the aspects which of historical fascism which are most influential in American extremist groups. They can't practice historical fascist politics, which was a politics of mass mobilization, because they can't generate that kind of support in the United States. And therefore, in this country, these groups turn toward terrorism and certain forms of violence, if or not merely withdrawal, which makes their action different from that of historical fascist groups in exact type, but certainly does not prevent it from being very destructive sometimes.
Pat Buchanan, of course, is a major force in the electoral political scene, I think it's fair to say, is now talking about either forming a third party or still being a part of the Republican Party and applying pressure. Some people have used that word to describe him. Do you think it's in any way accurate?
No. There are all different kinds of nationalists, and Buchanan presents a kind of nationalist rhetoric and program, which is quite militant, very conservative in some areas, but there are all different forms of nationalism, and to set off someone as a fascist, you have to really follow the ideas of physical aggression and violence and the kind of philosophical orientation of the fascists themselves. So fascism is a term that's used in quite a variety of ways. One way it's used simply is as a kind of pejorative for anyone who is quite anti-left-wing or strongly nationalist or opposed to certain major aspects of the status quo in a militant way in Europe or the United States. But the merely pejorative or polemical use of the term fascist confuses more than it helps. This was something begun by the communists back in the 1920s, but as early as 1928, the head of the Italian Communist Party, Palmiro Togliatti, who was one of the most intelligent European communists, pointed out that calling people fascist indiscriminately is useful for purposes of agitation and propaganda, but very confounding for terms of political analysis. So one should be careful not to confuse oneself by the kinds of terminology one applies.
In the time leading up to Mussolini, could you say the landscape looked anything like the United States? Here you say, you know, there's just no real fertile ground for this to take root in any mass way. Could you say the same about Italy or in Germany before it took hold?
There one had societies which were undergoing decisive political changes and a great deal of turmoil. This sort of thing is not the case in the United States, although we are in a period of some change. It seems to me that probably the major point of comparison between the United States at the present time and what we would call the fascist situations or the fascistogenic situations in Europe between the wars has to do more with aspects of culture than with specific aspects of politics or economics per se. That is, a great deal of cultural confusion and a shift in values and some attitudes, which tends to open up a certain kind of philosophical vacuum in politics that had not existed, for example, in Europe before World War I, had not existed in the United States as much 10 years ago as at the present time. So I'd say it's particularly the cultural and moral confusion of the country, which is the only aspect that bears some direct comparison with the situations in Europe before World War II.
Let's end on the note of the militias in this country. Are you surprised by them? How would you describe them?
Well, one is surprised by these things always in a certain sense because of their extremism. On the other hand, one has to remember that the militias, and there are several kinds of militias, after all. Some of them are ultra-Christian, some of them are not, some of them are highly racist, some of them are not so racist, have their roots in historical American libertarianism, the idea of being against the government and doing your own thing. This is a very American kind of orientation, and one doesn't find it to the same extent in any other country in the entire world. That is, the militia phenomenon, although some of the militia leaders are really influenced by fascist ideas, is as American as apple pie in a certain sense. It really goes back to the whiskey rebellions and a variety of phenomena in American history, and it does have roots in American society. Because of some problems that we have today, which are now more severe than was the case 10 or 20 years ago, this sort of thing now is finding some expression and expressing itself sometimes in very violent ways.
Was it Huey Long who said, fascism will come to America wrapped in an American flag?
This is, of course, the case with any form of nationalist movement. It has to have a patriotic and nativist kind of wrapping. Huey Long, of course, was one candidate for a kind of American fascism, but he wasn't. Huey was really just a socioeconomic demagogue who never got that far in national politics. He was, however, of course, the person who was most feared by Franklin Roosevelt in 1935.
Stanley Payne is the author of The History of Fascism, 1914 to 1945. Whether or not fascism could make a comeback, it's certainly a concern in Europe, where right-wing nationalist movements are growing in strength. Many Americans were startled by the early victories of presidential candidate Patrick Buchanan, but political observers in Europe find Buchanan and his ideas uncomfortably familiar. Sarah Chase reports from Paris.
We've stood with South Carolina. I want him to stand with me. Stand with me for a new conservatism of the heart that looks out for those Americans who have no voice and those Americans losing their jobs when these factories move overseas.
That's Pat Buchanan during a recent campaign speech. But if the language were French, it could be Jean-Marie Le Pen, head of France's ultra-right National Front.
Ce sont les hommes politiques français.
French politicians are, in my opinion, exclusively responsible. What brings immigrants to France? French egalitarianism. We gave everyone, even illegal immigrants, the same social benefits as French people got. And now they even get extra social benefits, what you in America call affirmative action. Why, under these circumstances, wouldn't billions, hundreds of millions of people come, since they know that by coming to France, they will make 10, 20 times as much not working as they would if they stayed at home and worked?
des Français. Leur volonté de non...
Le Pen, who's championed nationalist and anti-immigration themes for decades, won only a fraction of a percentage point when he ran for president in 1974. Last year, he scored 15% of the vote. Observers say Le Pen's growing popularity is a result of France's drawn-out economic crisis. But they also fault the traditional political parties, whose positions on major issues have grown increasingly similar. René Raymond is a historian and political scientist.
Or, depuis une dizaine d'années, on a vu...
Over the last 10 years, we've seen a growing number of voters split off from the traditional political parties and vote for spinner groups that don't really have a program. It's a sign of the electorate's dissatisfaction with the major parties, on the right as well as the left, that have disappointed them, partly because they don't offer a clear vision anymore and they've lost their ideological landmarks and they're powerless against the growth of unemployment.
Still, the National Front vote isn't just a throwaway protest vote. It's solidifying and growing. In the central French department of the Rhône, National Front activists disentangle plastic chairs for their weekly meeting from stacks of boxes. Headquarters is about to move to a larger building.
Bonsoir. Bonsoir.
The National Front doubled its number of city councillors in the eastern part of the department in municipal elections last year. Alain Breuil, city councillor in the working-class town of Saint-Priest, says he's emphasized grassroots organizing.
Every Sunday, for example, I am with some member of the National Front in the main market of my city of Saint-Priest, and we give papers and information to people. We do this nearly every week.
Breuil's political program is simple. Preference for French citizens in the distribution of jobs and social benefits. Lower taxes... and increased police presence, especially in the immigrant neighborhoods.
Young people, especially from Africa, we have to say the truth. We have just problem with people, young people from North Africa and sometimes like Africa, have to understand that they are in France. It's a great luck for them, and they have to adopt our law, our way of living, and they can't do and live as if there were no police and no mayor and no law and nothing else.
On the national level, Jean-Marie Le Pen continues to hammer the immigration issue. But with more and more of his votes coming from the working class, he started emphasizing working class issues, just like Buchanan. He's begun supporting the minimum wage for the first time. And he's attacked multinational corporations and the global economy. According to Patrick Silberstein of RALE Front, an anti-fascist group that observes National Front activities, this is a big switch for a man who used to call himself the French Reagan.
This is a big change in their policy, and it, in my opinion, it shows that this National Front is not a right, ordinary right-wing party, but it's a real fascist party in a new way, because they have a national program, it's a national preference, and they have a social program for national preference. It means the minimum wages for French people, the social security for white people, and so on. And this is, I think, the most dangerous thing in the French politics today, because they are able to reach people who used to be to vote for the Labour parties in the past.
Jean-Marie Le Pen, like Buchanan, is not about to be elected president. Still, his ideas are making headway. Jacques Chirac's conservative government is about to announce a tough new set of immigration laws. And many say that so long as the mainstream political parties fail to address voters' legitimate concerns about the impact of the global economy, support for Le Pen will keep growing. And he's hardly alone in Europe. There's Jörg Haider, head of the Freedom Party, now the second largest political party in Austria, or Russia's Zhirinovsky. Jean-Marie Le Pen says he's been doing some networking.
My idea is the following. The nationalists, the patriots, let's call them, have conflicts of interest as neighbors, but they share a body of moral doctrines. They like their land, their families, the rootedness of their traditions. That should allow them to understand each other.
Le Pen says that at Zhirinovsky's wedding in Moscow recently, he only half-jokingly made a toast, "Nationalists of the world, unite." For Pacifica Network News, I'm Sarah Chase in Paris.
This is Democracy Now! Coming up, a reverend in the 85th day of a fast, he's protesting the U.S. embargo on Cuba. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, where voices of dissent are commonplace. I'm Amy Goodman, and I'm joined now by Reverend Lucius Walker of Pastors for Peace. He's in the 85th day of a hunger strike. He's trying to get the United States government to release hundreds of computers and allow them to be shipped to Cuba for use in hospitals and medical clinics. I have to start by asking you, Reverend Walker, how are you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling encouraged today because our network around the country has shown unusual stamina and persistence. It's been 85 days, and they've maintained pressure on the government to release the computers in spite of, until now, not having a computer released. You know, we're not accustomed to hanging in that long with no results. And I want to dedicate this day to the thousands upon thousands of people around this country who have consistently waged a relentless campaign of calls and faxes to the Treasury Department and the White House, because they're the ones who are the real heroes of this struggle.
Now, I want to take a step back, because not a lot of people know what it is that you're doing. This is a major problem in the media now in terms of reporting on this fast. I mean, 85 days, you're almost in the going into the fourth month of a fast.
That's correct.
How did this all get started?
On January 31st, 70 caravanistas were attempting to carry...
Caravanistas, you're saying?
Caravanistas were attempting to carry 395 very simple, low-level, early-generation computers that had been donated by people in various parts of the country to Cuba to install them and to give them to churches that was going to oversee their distribution to clinics and hospitals in many parts of the country, particularly some of the rural and mountain areas. The U.S. Customs Service, along with eight other federal agencies, spent, it has been estimated, well over $1 million, and of course they're still spending, to stop the delivery of what they have estimated to be about $200,000 worth of equipment.
Now, this is a part of a tradition. We should put this in a little context here. This was what, your sixth Cuba caravan?
Mm-hmm.
In the past, you've brought food, you've brought medicine. What else?
The first caravan was Bibles, bicycles, and school supplies, and we were arrested for simply taking those things. But there was such
Did you get them in, though?
We got everything in. There was such an outcry from the public that the government had to back off. And we received a letter before the second caravan saying, well, school supplies, Bibles, and bicycles can go, but you can't take vehicles. We had announced we would take a vehicle because a couple of churches in Cuba had requested church buses. And one of the vehicles went through in the main body of the caravan, and the last vehicle in the caravan was a yellow school bus, which I was driving, and that was seized. We did a 23-day hunger strike, and there was an international outcry because this great nation, a big nation, had seized a yellow school bus. The school bus was released. The third caravan was preparing to go. We got a letter saying school supplies, Bibles, and bicycles can go, and vehicles, but you can't take electrical equipment. Because a group in Wisconsin had donated a truckload of electric sewing machines. Well, they stopped that truck and insisted that the driver cut the cords off. That's how vicious and mean-spirited they are.
Cut the cords off the sewing machine?
Off of the sewing machines. And after cutting five or six, he just threw the knife down and said, "I can't. You cut them off or arrest me." And even the customs officials couldn't cut the cords off. So that truck, minus six without cords, went to Cuba. So you see, every time, what I'm saying in answer to your question is we've pushed the parameters. We've forced them to, quote, liberalize, unquote, their definition of what humanitarian aid is. And this is now the sixth caravan.
Have you gotten computers in before?
Yes. 18 of the computers that are now a part of the system for medical information in Cuba were delivered on our last caravan. We have gotten computers over on several occasions. We have this documented on film. And therefore, we assume that, particularly since we were taking XTs and 286 computers that many people in the U.S. use for doorstops, for decoration, or just store in their closets, that these would go through with no trouble. And yet the government expended all of this energy and the time, human personnel, to prevent this simple act of love from taking place.
Now, we're talking to Reverend Lucius Walker, who's in the 85th day of a fast, part of Pastors for Peace. He's striking against the U.S. embargo on Cuba. And I should say that we did invite the Treasury Department on to be a part of this conversation.
Great. I hope they come.
We've talked with them over the last few days, in fact, over the last few weeks. Now, they have gracefully declined, they said, but a few of their comments on the telephone, when I asked, are they going to let you die? I mean, 85 days of a fast is quite serious. They responded, it's not as if we have you tied up in the basement of the Treasury Department and are preventing you from eating. That's your choice. Also, when we talked about you challenging the law, in a previous conversation, the Treasury Department official says, why don't you buy a congressman like anyone else? Why don't we talk about Congress and what kind of support you're getting there?
We have wrought a miracle, we think, in this post-Brothers to the Rescue climate, post the passage of Helms-Burton, and with President Clinton having totally caved in and given the Jorge Mascanosas of this world more than they ask for.
Let's go back again. When you say Helms-Burton, explain what it is for people who are not quite up on this strengthening of the U.S. embargo.
Helms-Burton, Jesse Helms, Senator from North Carolina, Dan Burton, Congressperson from Indiana, co-sponsored legislation to further tighten the blockade against Cuba. It is draconian. It is absurd. Most of the members of the Congress who voted for it realize that it's unenforceable. But in this climate of hostility and venom towards Cuba, it passed. And
it passed right after Cuba shot down the planes of the Cubans coming from Miami.
And in that climate, we have visited over 120 congressional offices, and we have more than 70 members of Congress who have gone on record, either with phone calls or letters, publicly supporting our efforts to get the computers through to Cuba.
Who is leading the support in Congress?
The major spokesperson on this is Congressperson Charles Rangel from Harlem. He's been simply wonderful. He's taken this on as an issue. but he would be the first to say that he has been joined by a strong coterie of members of Congress who feel incensed about this and who are willing to go on the public record to say this is a stupid policy which must be ended and these simple computers ought to be allowed to go to Cuba.
One of the things the Treasury Department says is that you have not even given in a request to get these computers through.
That's a lie.
Have you signed?
Yes.
What have you signed?
We have not applied for a license, that is certain. And we have
and
said,
they say you have to apply for a license.
And we have been very clear to them that in no other instance is it necessary to have a license to take simple, non-strategic humanitarian aid to churches in other countries.
They say, again, this is in conversation with the Treasury Department, and I wish that they were here to say it themselves. They say that you say these computers are for health clinics, but in fact, anything that goes to Cuba probably ends up in a communist government office.
Mm-hmm. Well, anything that goes to Cuba for health services will end up in one of the finest healthcare systems in this hemisphere. I want to tell you a story. I tell the listeners a story. When we were in the Fast for Life in San Diego, right at the Mexican border, one morning at about 7:30, we were awakened by a visitor who said he had just returned from Mexico, where he purchased medicines, which he does monthly. But it turned out that this guy worked in one of the largest hospitals in San Diego, and doesn't have health care, can't afford to buy the medicines in the hospital where he works, and has to go to Mexico to buy medicines that he can afford. That's the health care system in this country. And here we were in a fast for life to plead with our government to allow these medical computers to go to a country that provides health care for its people. So for this finest healthcare system in the hemisphere, we're attempting to deliver simple aid. Yes, it will go to the people of this country, and it is a system which is endorsed by the government and supported by the government.
How can they use the computers in the clinics?
To develop programs for inventory. Right now in Cuba, inventory of supplies, equipment is done manually. To provide a database of information for medical students to study, to provide information for specialized operational procedures in various remote parts of the country so that specialists can be in direct communication with the doctors that are in the mountains to provide directions for specialized operations. And finally, to provide information for many of the medical personnel in some of the rural regions to indicate the properties of the herbs that grow in that region so they can expand their green medicine program.
Reverend Lucius Walker, speaking of communications, are you in direct communication with Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin?
I am not in direct communication. I would be happy to be, but I have not had the privilege of talking with him. He has been in direct communication with members of Congress. Staff of the Treasury Department have been in direct communication with Congressman Rangel and other members.
And what are they saying? What's the Treasury Department telling you now?
The latest development is that we have a statement, an announcement from the Treasury Department that the Canadian computers, and I know I'll have to explain what that means, but there are 23 computers out of the lot of 395 that were donated by Canadians, and they entered the U.S. at the Washington state border with under a bond, $100 paid by the Canadians, with the guarantee that they would go through the U.S. and exit into Mexico. But instead of allowing them to exit, the customs officials in San Diego seized them and would not allow them to go on to Mexico. They are now under this announcement made 3 days ago to be released. However, I must hasten to add that as of yet they have not been released.
In fact, one of the four Fasters, you are part of this group of four, he has gone there. He's
yes.
The Canadian, is that right, who's
Brian,
gone to San Diego?
Brian Rohatyn is now in San Diego along with representatives of a religious coalition representing major denominations in this country, such as the Episcopal Church, the Progressive National Baptist Convention, the American Baptist Convention, the United Methodist Church, and the National Council of Churches. They are in San Diego waiting for the Treasury Department to fulfill its announcement.
Now, recently we just got a press release saying that there was a group of people supporting you, including 1199, the largest independent union in New York, the Health and Hospitals Union, Dennis Rivera. What kind of support have you gotten, and from which groups?
We have gotten support from labor unions, from church groups, from Cuban American organizations, from a number of professional organizations.
How about corporations? I mean, many corporations in this country are not happy with the embargo because this means other countries and companies from there are doing the investment in Cuba they'd like to be doing.
We have no support from corporations. We have lip service from corporations. We know that over 100 U.S. corporations have gone to Cuba illegally, violating the blockade, and they have secretly signed letters of intent with Cuba so that they'll be first in line when the blockade ends, because they know that the blockade is wrong and that it must end. They also, U.S. corporations also know that it's not in the interest of their business for the blockade to continue. So they're lining up. But they won't go public and be a force within our democratic system to force the government to end the blockade.
Do you think that there is a more effective strategy now than fasting? I mean, you're fasting to get computers into the country. Maybe that isn't something that's grabbing the heart of American people, because it's computers. It's not food. It's not medicine.
There may be, for some people, more effective strategies, and we would welcome and affirm any strategy that anyone can use. What I should say to you is that, thank God, we chose to fast at the time we did, because we began the fast 3 days before the downing of the Brothers to the Rescue planes. And were we not in the trenches, on the ground, in this act of civil disobedience, there would have not been a symbol, a soul, a center around which the solidarity movement in this country could have rallied when the Helms-Burton bill was passed. Because when the Helms-Burton bill passed, it struck, you know, despair in the hearts of the solidarity movement. And even until now, there has not been a gathering, unfortunately, of the solidarity community in this country to mount an aggressive counteraction against the passage of the Helms bill, so that the work that has been being done has in solidarity has been centered around this fast. Now, if there's something better, let's have it, and we'll support it. But until that happens, I think it's fair and right for us to call for all people of goodwill to support what we're doing.
Have you gotten any coverage, the broadcasting networks in this country?
We've gotten limited coverage. There's been a very effective, I must admit, whiteout of this effort. But we have made some breakthroughs. We thank God for Pacifica around the country. Thank God for stations like KPFA, and thank God for people like Denise Manzari in Connecticut. And we forced, because of FAIR and our own networks calling and writing to NPR, them to give coverage, which was very, very poor coverage.
We saw the letter they got you just the day before that piece came out. But what about Cuban coverage? Is Cuba taking notice of this fast?
It is center stage. It is frontline, headline news in Cuba and in other countries in the world. But in the U.S., the free press has not chosen to give this information to its people.
Reverend Lucius Walker, are you fasting until death?
I think the more important question is, how long will the U.S. government hold on to these computers? I'm fasting until the computers are released. I live with the hope that our country will not continue to prevent simple computers from going to people. And I want to add that we're not going to buy a congressperson. That's not the way the democratic system is supposed to work.
A phone number where people can get in touch with you. We have 10 seconds.
202-488-5654, or in New York City at our national office, 212-926-5757. But I also, if you will allow, want to urge people to call Washington.
We have to stop it there. I have to thank you very much, Reverend Lucius Walker, for joining us this morning. Reverend Lucius Walker in the 85th day of his hunger fast protesting the U.S. embargo on Cuba. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!